So, is everybody settled? Happily positioned? I would like to continue, being the strict and cruel timekeeper. I would like to introduce our first speakers. We are able to welcome today Petra van Brabant, who holds a PhD and did postdoctoral research in feminist social moral philosophy at the University of Antwerp, also of San Francisco and in Edinburgh. She teaches at Art College St. Lucas in Antwerp. She teaches semiotics, art theory, cultural criticism, and art and context. And she currently is working on a research in art and narrativity, art and pornography, laziness, and post-Fordist society. The second speaker, this will be a double talk, is Robrecht van der Beke. He is a philosopher. He published recently, in recent years, a lot on blogs and papers on cultural policy. He's preparing a book which is called Bye Bye Art, on the marketization of art and culture, which will be published by EPO in April. And starting next month, Robrecht will join the team of the notorious bookshop in Antwerp called De Groene Waterman to collaborate on the cultural program then. Please welcome Robrecht and Petra.
Okay, good morning. First of all, our compliments to SOTA for making this event possible. It's quite great to see this self-organizing spirit at work, triggered by this collective concern about austerity. So here we go, to develop a critical take on cultural politics together, and that's what we plan to do today. Such a task is quite a difficult and an energy-consuming exercise, but it's crucial to take that effort step by step, even on Sundays, because it's important in terms of raising awareness, triggering discussion and mobilization, but it is especially important for the long-term development of an alternative perspective in an open and a democratic stance. That's the challenge that state of the art is after, and that's also a strong antidote to what probably is the biggest deadlock today, that is cynicism and pragmatism. So let's start. As a warm-up for the discussion, Petra and I thought it would be good to zoom in on the language that is used in cultural politics. And as you all know, the words we use create our worldview and hence our world. Yet, since discourse is power, those in power are framing the meanings of our words. They generate their own expressions and claims. They claim the words that we all use, and in the end, we wake up in a world that we don't recognize any longer. In response, some think that we need a new lexicon, that we have to invent a new language, but we can also just reclaim our language. Take, for instance, the expression loonkloof, the wage gap, the wage handicap. According to our government, this is the main political concern today, but the problem is not, in their view, that the CEOs earn 300 times as much as the employee on the work floor. No, what they mean is that normal jobs, social security, and good labor conditions are an obstacle for a profit-driven economy. So, wage gap, you have one word, two oppositional meanings. Another example of framing, what we call cuts in public budgets, are in fact transfers from the social and cultural domain to private interests. Prime Minister Geert Bourgeois himself proudly declared in Unizo magazine that, and I quote, the extra measures to support business will completely be funded with means from the cuts. So there you go, that's what austerity really is about. It's about going from a welfare state for social and cultural needs to a welfare state for business. Hence, if the art world starts fighting for each other's funding now, stating that this or that art form is mediocre, for instance, we give the minister austerity claims or arguments on a silver plate. So I think it's better that we're not an accomplice in organizing our own closeout sale or organizing our own transfers. There is no shame in the fact that a cultural sector requires public investment. The shame is rather that a government who spends 12 billion euro to fund business each year, not taking into account 3.5 billion tax reduction for company cars, feels it is impossible to keep supporting culture with a total budget less than 500 million, using the argument, of course, there is no alternative. Framing, that's how ideology works, and in order to develop our discourse today, let's take note at some common rhetoric trickery. We will discuss a list of expressions, you can call it a catch-22 glossary, as a warning for slippery slopes into neoliberal cultural politics. While preparing this talk, Petra and I gathered a list of at least 10 points, but due to the time limit, we will restrict ourselves and only mention some. These points can also be called red herrings of cultural policy. In philosophy, a red herring is something that you flag as problematic because it involves a deceiving strategy or some hocus-pocus. The original expression red herring, by the way, comes from a technique in hunting. In order to mislead the hunting dogs, smoked herrings were thrown around to put them on the wrong track. So in short, our concern in this talk is what are the red herrings in cultural politics and especially how can we reclaim our vocabulary. So Petra will discuss the first point.
Good noon. The first red herring we will talk about is participation. So I promised Robert and myself that I would not derive from my text, but I will do it anyway. I heard Christoph telling us the anecdote about some kind of participation, as political participation. We wanted to talk about art participation. But nevertheless, also that political participation is a red herring, if you heard how it went. So this kind of participation is very, very dangerous, because you are united in a group that is not united in the first place, so you're all there as individuals who have not got the chance to unite. And then secondly, the methodology is organized in such a way that there's no possibility of uniting. So I really think that Christoph and the others should really fight against that text, and that the organization who staged coming together should really take distance of it and write no text and deliver no text to not that text. There are other texts that have been written in sort of real participative choreography. So I think this is very important. It's really shameful, the anecdote. I was really shocked. But now I go to my text. So, the first red herring is participation. We all like the word participation, but it can mean quite different things. For some people, participation is bigger audience or let the consumer decide. Some cultural managers, like the director of the Stadshouwburg in Amsterdam, Melle Damen, said in an interview in Recto Verso that she really knows what the people want. She just counts the tickets sold. It is a quite tricky position of hers. You know that we can also tell you what the best film was in 2014 based on the tickets sold. It was The Hobbit Part 2. So Melle Damen's methodology is quite problematic, if you ask me. We all know for a long time that mass entertaining, notwithstanding its craftsmanship and its technological qualities, is very problematic. It puts diversity, experiment, and complexity under pressure, because it is a business, and if you get rid of the codes, the existing codes, you're taking risks that you can't afford. Complexity, diversity, and experiment are no guarantee for profit. But what we tend to forget is the other side of participation, is also that the audience or the public is also often a product of the market, if it's an audience without or not having had a chance of art education. So power to the people is indeed a great ideal, but without art education, what the people want, that Melle Damen knows so very well, means actually let the market decide what art is. And of course, there is a lot of bad art that warrants the lack of participation. And the arts have their ideological cries in themselves, like society in general has. Yet, the austerity police has not the expertise to take over art critique and misuse it as an argument to make cuts in the art sector. Yet, that's what people like Tom Nagels, a sidekick for VOCA, are doing today. Replying that the overall number of occupied seats has increased is actually phrasing the game in their way. We should rephrase participation as a project of art education and not follow the game of the austerity police at being art critics and head counters. Unfortunately, that's what the problem is. Participation by means of education is not what our current policy is aiming at. With participation, they bluntly mean mass attendance and big cultural events with lots of exposure, like you have seen last week, the big light festival in Ghent, which was another art theme park. So let's reclaim the meaning of participation. We need more art education, and even for artists, enabling them to make their own platforms and to make their own school. So first word to reclaim, I think, is participation, and reclaim it in terms of art education.
A second red herring. Lots of policymakers and academics discuss the importance of public funding in terms of market failure. What they mean is that public service is necessary in all these cases where there is no market. So put differently, only if the market fails to provide, because no profit can be made, government should step in. That's the idea. The problem here is, first of all, that you systematically want to comprehend public funding in a subordinate relation to the market. When there is the need for something, a public service is to be developed, but when the market can take over, we should back off. So the question is, why is that? If something is successful, why should we automatically open it up for private interests to make profit? Why should public services only take care of what is fragile and costly? Society has to pay the cost for building up cultural and social traditions, and once they are up and running, the market can take the benefits, and that's quite unfair. Secondly, it's simply not true that public services always is playing a complementary role today, despite what our government wants us to believe. Instead, their aim is to use the public capital as a lever, an investment and support program for the market economy. So that's not a complementary role, but a serving one. The complementary role argument only pops up in cases where the public service should go due to so-called competition infringement. A third problem is that in this talk of market failure, it appears as if what the market does is not problematic. Problems only arise when the market fails to provide because no profit can be made. But isn't that a big smokescreen to cover up the many failures of the market, the markets in the heart of its successes? That is the intrinsic failures, the reduction of diversity, draining experiment, turning culture into commodification, exploitation, inequality, transforming the art world into a gated arena of competitors with winners and losers, big galleries investing in yet another expensive art fair because they are at war with the monopoly of auction houses, and so on. So, words to reclaim. We can agree with policymakers in their view that public service should be an answer to market failure, but only on the condition that we're talking about the intrinsic failure. And in this sense, the market failure means the failure of the market in what it does, not in what it not does. So let's reclaim the mission of the public service as a wholesome alternative to the market, simply because it is our democratic right in a modern society to collectively organize education, culture, healthcare, mobilization, and so on, or also a market-free zone for artists to work and experiment, or cultural labs that can innovate and start new collaborations as commons for the benefit of everyone. The idea of having a democratic and public service is obvious, but we seem to have forgotten how self-evident it is. Petra.
The next red herring, the third one, is fitness. So the third red herring started with a radio interview our Minister of Cultural calling for more survival of the fittest in the cultural sector. Instead of collaboration, competition is needed, which is not only cost-reducing, but also good for innovation. Here we hear a classical liberal tune playing in the background. The arts will compete more, and therefore perform better, with less state pampering. But hold on for a second. It's not actually a larger part of God's policy, his cultural policy, the plan to transform the arts field into a service club for economical development, city marketing, top events, and so on. Isn't it contradictory to argue for austerity in the art sector to enhance competition and fitness, and at the same time announce a new pampering of the market by reshaping arts into a service for private interest and profit-driven innovation? Shouldn't we remind Hetz of his own fitness logic? Yet, there is much more. There are more fundamental problems with his fitness discourse. The minister completely misunderstands the concept of fitness, using terminology from evolutionary biology to contemplate culture is very problematic and quite stupid, honestly. The minister must have read too much pop science. So a few arguments to illustrate why it is quite stupid. First of all, we bump into what philosophers call the naturalistic fallacy. It is not because things are the way they are in nature that they are also good, hence that they are also desirable. So it's not because something is in nature that way, that natural way is a good way, and therefore a desirable way. After all, every culture is developed to deal with the needs that we are lacking in nature. But there's more. Second, new research in biology, research that has already been popularized. It's not that it's cutting-edge research, like the research of Frans de Waal, shows that we, the Homo sapiens sapiens, is by nature a social being. Our fitness depends more on our skills to collaborate and be empathetic, not on competition. Thirdly, if we really want to go along with this evolutionary metaphors, note that fitness in evolutionary biology is something that is generated thanks to diversity. Useless and really useless qualities develop freedom and randomly in nature and might, but also might not, prove fit in new environments. So a cultural policy that truly wants to enhance fitness should provide in a horizontal and diverse ecosystems so that new things can grow. Those new things might be totally unadapted to current circumstances, yet they might show an unexpected fitness, or not, under a sudden environmental change. So words to reclaim, yes, fitness. We need fitness, indeed, because fitness is about investing in a rich and horizontal field. Cultural politics should resist the obsession with what is big and successful now, with top institutions, spectacular events, or Vlaamse kwaliteitsinstellingen. Conclusion, fitness as cultivating a wide diversity in which uselessness and Homo sapiens sapiens empathy and collaboration can thrive.
Voor de and-and model, het en-en model. Our minister wants to introduce the Anglo-Saxon model, but he calls it an and-and challenge. So he wants to mix the continental and the Anglo-Saxon way, combining the best of the two worlds. That's the idea. The first problem is that this and-and model actually means the exact opposite of what it intends to do, because our current reality is already an and-and situation. We have, on the one hand, art market, creative industries, mass entertainment, and on the other hand, we have a public cultural sector that nonetheless already is quite infected with corporate logic. What the minister really wants is to dispense with this situation of having a commercial next to a non-commercial practice And so the way to do that is that the public sector needs to open up for private interests to come in, and at the same time, the budget, the public budget, the Kunstdecreet, should also go out for the use of commercial organizations like galleries. So in short, this ministerial end-to-end talk actually is about ending our current situation, which already is an end-to-end situation, turning it into one big blur. So, words to reclaim, yes, we want a kind of end-to-end as well, but we want both, but the one next to the other, which means you have a public free zone as a democratic exception to commercial power plays, games. The second problem is that GATS presents the Anglo-Saxon model as a solution in times of austerity, because you aim for private support. So, although we should accept the reduction of public funding because there is no alternative, all sorts of fiscal constructs like tax shelter can come to the rescue. That's the idea. But of course, the Anglo-Saxon model is not a solution to austerity. It's actually the austerity model itself, because it's about creating a welfare state for private economical interests. The big lie is that the Anglo-Saxon way is cheaper for society. It's the opposite. If private capital is really interested in art, they're free to invest. Some art-loving collectors are already doing so. So the question is, why do others need the state to invent all sorts of constructs first? And the answer is simple. They're waiting for business deals to, in a way, to milk a society like a cow. Three brief examples. Tax shelter in the film industry is successful, according to GATS, because in his view it realized an extra 25 euro the last couple of years. So is it? He's counting the gain for producers, not the cost for society. Note that an investor in tax shelter gets a fiscal reduction of 150%, and since January this year, this increased to 310%. So for every euro you invest, you get 3 euros back. We are clearly not talking about an investment model, but about an earning model. Also, as a result, a variety of speculation pops up, because this, of course, is a very profitable business, and this business gives priority to commercial values, oppressing artistic values. Since 2004, tax shelter already costs the taxpayer about 1 billion euros, so quite a budget. You can make lots of art with that, and probably it will be better stuff than the movie The Loft, for instance, for sure. A second example, private-public structures, the so-called PPS. You have the public projects including private investors. That's also, for instance, how the Brussels government wants to fund the new museum in the Citroën Garage. PPS is quite appealing for policymakers, because they can start with big projects that attract lots of attention without spending too much of their budget during their time in office. So the idea is that you push the bill into the future, so you can lavishly spend the budget of your successors by signing all sorts of non-transparent contracts. Note that the Court of Accounts of our government, at Rekenhof, is warning our policymakers since 2009 that the cost of PPS is expanding in an unacceptable manner. The total cost in 2009 was 33 million. In 2014, it will already be 290 million. And in 2019, it will be about 650 million, not included the Oosterweel dossier, which costs 6 to 7 billion alone. So, PPS is totally undermining the democratic power of future policymakers. It enslaves them, in fact, with debt and fiscal deals. A third example, the famous art foundations in the States, like the Guggenheim, the Getty, Hammer, Hirschhorn, and what have you. They are not just the result of a selfless philanthropy. The fiscal policy in the States allows art investors to recoup expenses from their taxes, so you get a free big bonus to invest in art, which already is a quite very lucrative business. Also, these private art foundations can work tax-free, what comes in very handy to organize all sorts of business-related activities under this umbrella, not to mention the whitewashing. And if art collectors donate work to a society, they can have a refund up to 50% of the estimated amount, the estimated price. So note that you don't really have to have a buyer. You can just copy the price of the auction houses. And of course, if you have a lot of money, there are ways to fix or influence at least these prices. Finally, let's not forget the overall symbolic bonus here in the Anglo-Saxon way. It looks like private entrepreneurs are benefactors of art and culture, but in reality, society is paying more than double. It's actually a progressive waste of public money for private interests and prestige. In short, the Anglo-Saxon model is an earning model that arranges all sorts of fiscal business deals, and we should debunk it. So don't call it philanthropy, but rather clientelism, and don't let business be the curator. Conclusion, we want an end-to-end model, therefore we need to resist this Anglo-Saxon model, which is just another word for the austerity model.
Okay, we have a few other words, but time is up. We had autonomy, which is actually used as a word for, a beautiful word for precarity, and we want to reclaim it as sovereignty, and sovereignty means no precarity. You can't be sovereign if you're in precarious conditions. We had cultural governance in the sense that we have to reclaim our own, as artists, our own cultural governance and make the institutions work for our governance and not follow the governance that they think out for us. And we had a long conclusion in which I had four battlegrounds to take into account today. The battleground, the states, the institutions, facilitating and managing institutions, but also the art institutions, those who program us. But another and last battleground is artists themselves. I mean, we are our own battleground in a sense. We have to unite and we have to reform our subjectivity, which is completely structured also by neoliberal system. So these battlegrounds are important in the sense that it's not by being nice to each other that we will get any progress. It's in conflict, and only in harsh conflicts that you reach your destination, in the sense of you can reach points in conflict that you could never reach without conflict. So let your discussion be, on your debating, be polite, but don't be too nice to yourself, to the institutions, and especially not to politicians. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Petra and Robrecht.
Round one.
Five cases or examples relevant to the point you are discussing that you know from your own practice, that you've seen, that you've encountered in the world. Please make groups, four groups per point, and come up with five examples or cases per group. Thank you. You have half an hour. I will let you know when there's only 5 minutes left.